Good morning. I'm going to present a format or a process that we're using in Colorado to create an inclusive, useful, effective framework to address hepatitis C in our state. And we started with the continuum of care. There are a few of these around. And this is the one that we chose, and you can't see it. Sorry about that. It basically starts with primary prevention, goes to early infection and diagnosis, entry into care, then hopefully people get ongoing services if they're infected and ultimately get cured. This is a similar continuum that we're using for HIV and other sexually transmitted infections in our HIV STI viral hepatitis branch. So with the continuum, we had to address these kind of who, what, where questions. What do we want to know and for what purpose? Who else wants to know it? What information is available? And then the result is some poignant questions in which we had a set of questions to answer under each segment of the continuum. So what do we need to know? Well, we need to know what the epidemic looks like. So we have, and many of you actually, have already answered some of the questions related to the geography and the demographics. But in public health, we sometimes have a harder time understanding who's getting tested and who's getting care and treatment. And so there are certainly some gaps that we don't always have the best information for. And then the reason that we needed to know this is because these new cures have elevated interest in hepatitis C, but their cost is leading to competing priorities among constituents and even some of our sister state agencies. So we are promoting testing for hepatitis C, and then Medicaid pushes back that if there's more demand for testing, then there's going to be more demand for treatment, and that has budgetary issues. And so we need to sort of plan together as much as we can in order to have a balanced response and appropriate budgeting. And then who else wants to know? So this is not an exhaustive list of who's involved, but certainly public health wants to know. This is an infectious disease that impacts thousands of people in our state. Advocacy groups want to know. Denver Health did a pilot project. Insurance. So within our state, we have just public health, Medicaid, corrections, behavioral health, Department of Insurance, and we're all tasked with implementing some type of a vision on behalf of the governor. And, you know, so there's some internal tension amongst us. And then externally, we have local health departments, advocacy groups, the federally qualified health centers, the rural health centers, physician groups. And they also have their questions that they need to answer for policy and budget reasons. So this process started a couple years ago, and it continues to add members as we go along. We realize we need to know this piece of information or that piece of information. So in the fall of 2014, Hep C Connection, which is a Denver-based advocacy group, actually took the lead, brought in some speakers, and they had a six-hour meeting on a Saturday. And that kind of kicked things off. And since then, we at the health department have had a series of four data meetings, and at each meeting we address a different part of the continuum in the data that we have, and then we try to answer the questions with the data, and people are picking apart the data. It's a very lively conversation. You know, this isn't good enough, you need to look at it this way, and it means this, no, it means that, and it's actually very good. So the health department brings its data. We have cancer registry data, but we're doing a match with our disease reporting data. We have hospital discharge data. We have an immunization registry. Hepatitis C is reportable in the state of Colorado. We do get electronic lab reports from all of the major labs. We do have some electronic health record access through the university system. We have reviewed co-infection and updated that, and that'll soon be on our website. So it's really been a catalyst because I will tell you, our program is two perinatal case managers, a part-time nurse, an adult viral hepatitis prevention coordinator, and me. So as we've gotten some of these other folks involved in our health department, it has really magnified our resources in terms of analysis. And then our external partners bring their data, and That includes the State Department of Corrections, which tests all their inmates on intake and has about 20% of them test antibody positive. That includes the all payers claims data, which is 65% of the insured population in our state, both commercial and public. It doesn't include self-funded plans, military, those sorts of folks. It includes our Medicaid data, and I might think that I've done a good literature review and somebody else shows up and they've got another article and another piece, another avenue to look at. And then Homi Razavi from the Center for Disease Analysis is trying to customize the NHANES data to our state. And so we do have gaps in our data, but there's but there's still a lot of data. And so it's not so much a shortage of data, it's a shortage of our capacity to analyze that data. And so in the end, we really have to look through the, find the forest through the trees. And we have to recognize that everybody has their own policies, budgets, different things that they need to address. And the nice thing about this is these get exposed when we're all having a talk about the data. And so we need to listen to each other. We're listening to each other through the process rather than getting it all published and pushing it out and then having people push back. We also, though, with limited staff, really have to manage the process. So the continuum has helped us. This time we're working on prevention. Next time we're working on diagnosis. You know, how many people are being tested? What does that really mean? So each time we're meeting, we're really getting kind of down to the nitty-gritty. But we have to be flexible because people's timelines change, whether they have a grant or policy. And so when we're going through and we're looking at this all of this data and trying to figure out what does it mean, we do go back to some of our guideposts, which is and some of the data that we know. And I'll skip that last one. So we do our back of the envelope calculations. We realize we have 35 to 50,000 people in Colorado who need treatment. That costs $1 to $3 million. We don't have it. And so we drill down in the data some more. And this particular graphic shows that when we match our disease reports to death certificate data, people 50 to 59 have the highest rate of death for all causes, and the greatest number of the folks in the 50 to 54 year old age group had a diagnosis within 3 years of death. So right there, that tells us we need to be doing something. We could be diagnosing people sooner, and we could be addressing, and that it's a significant health impact if that many people are dying in our state. And then when we looked at our all payers claims data, there's a recommendation to test baby boomers. Only 2% of them look like they're being tested per year, and that's an average for 2009 through 2013. Thanks.
Frank Harris, Washington State. I guess my question is really directed to any of the presenters that had high volume cases, the chlamydia or hepatitis C. Could you speak for just a few seconds on somewhat a rhetorical question, whether or not receiving electronic capable case reports rather than just electronic laboratory results would have sped up the process of investigation or reaching conclusions, even if you didn't have time to investigate everybody?
Let's do electronic case reporting.
Brian, you always have an ulterior motive there. Okay. Next question, please.
Hi, I'm Lindsay Chernian from the Division of STD Prevention at CDC. So this question is for Brittany. Thanks for evaluating out. It's exciting to see this data. I will say that the decreases in screening among young people is kind of concerning. So that's kind of a follow-on to Jillian's question. Well, you showed the overall case rate has some decreases. I wonder if you stratified by age and if you've seen any decreases among adolescents in diagnosis.
I haven't looked at that, but that's a great thing that I can get on and get back. So thank you.
don't worry, they're not hard. Okay. So the Legionella in Michigan, you mentioned that the hospitals were asked to do a culture if they started getting a certain number of urine antigens. I was wondering if you could explain that.
That was, I guess, one of my recommendations for improving surveillance. I just, like, whenever there's an increase, I guess it would be useful to start culturing so that you can have those clinical isolates. You know, if you see an increase over normal, potentially cluster an outbreak, and you want to be able to match those clinical isolates to any environmental isolates you might get. So it was really more in preparation for, like, an outbreak scenario. There have been situations in the past where we haven't gotten any clinical isolates at all. We only have the urinary antigen, and then we're kind of, our hands are tied when it comes to environmental isolates.
I didn't know if you had set a threshold or trigger of a start.
Having, yes. That was just one of my recommendations.
Legionella in Illinois. You mentioned the hospital discharge data, and I was wondering if you had identifiable data that you merged, or how easy it was for you to get access to this data.
So it was pretty easy to get access. A different division in.
Would you mind standing up so that everyone can hear a little more in the back?
It was pretty easy to get access to the data because we can work within our agency to get that.
Identifiable.
Yes. So we can go down. We didn't have names, but I did have birthday, county, race, and sex. And so I could get down to that level and compare side by side our surveillance data and then get a pretty good estimate of the comparing our surveillance data with that discharge data.
Okay. Lydia,
formerly
SMGA. On your communicable disease hotline, how did that work to get the Poison Control Center to agree and staff up? And I was wondering how that worked.
Thanks for your question. In Illinois, we actually fund the Illinois Poison Center through the health department. The money gets funneled through us, and we set up a contract with them. There's a precedent for having done it before, because for H1N1 in 2009, they had done the hotline. So it has been several years since we had activated the hotline, but there was a precedent for it. And it's a really good model, because they're really used to talking on the phone with a wide variety of people, and they have a clinical background. So we negotiated a contract with them based on call volume. But it's not cheap, even though we fund them.
They bring nurses in?
They have nurses who are on staff. They have pharmacists. And then to surge, they have pharmacy tech students who are doing rotations who can come in and help answer the call. So they have some surge capacity. They have three tiers. So they have their sort of normal staff who are there who can answer the calls. If it gets to the next level of calls, they bring in the students. And if it gets to an even higher volume, they have a secondary site where they have another phone bank, and they can bring in volunteers. So they have a pretty good scale.
Okay, finally, Rubella in New York City. I was wondering if you could explain how you determined the inappropriateness of the test.
So,
you said 72% were tested inappropriately. I was wondering how you determined.
Right, so as part of routine case investigation, we contact the provider who ordered the test and we ask why the test was ordered. And if the test was not ordered because the provider thought that there could be a rubella infection, anything other than that was really considered inappropriate. It could be it was ordered by accident, it could be because it was part of a prenatal panel and they just prenatal panel, or we're actually looking into that to find out a little bit more information about why exactly they're being ordered so we can have more effective education about appropriate ordering.
I actually have a kind of a follow-up question around inappropriate reporting for Brian. You indicated that quite a substantial number of your suspect TB cases had been inappropriately reported. Was this coming from providers or laboratories, and do you know what the reason was for those?
So we don't know for a lot of them because there's not any reason indicated. But most of them were from providers. So there could have been some indication they might have had TB, but they didn't check a box on like a form or something. Or they could have isolated them and not written that down. But we don't really know. But mostly from providers.
Along those lines, sorry. Do your providers know you have a rule that if they isolate someone for TB or start them on anti-TB meds, that that's the criteria for reporting?
It's widely available. I don't know if they know that. We've done a survey. But from anecdotal evidence, I think that the knowledge of the isolation rule is probably not widely known. And I think that a significant portion of the delayed reports are because they're not reporting during or after isolation.
Is that in your regulations for disease reporting?
Yes. Actually, I don't know if it's in the actual, I don't know if that's specified in the law, but it's published on our summary report that we publish on how to report TB case. Or
hi, Katie from Michigan. A question for the last presenter. You compare data quality for the online surveys and the public health surveys. What do you mean by data quality?
Sure. So basically what we did was the questionnaire was structured so anytime anyone said that yes, they ate one of those 95 foods, they were, I'm sure, it would pop up with a comment box next to it and it would prompt them to enter some information about it. What brand was it? Was it homegrown? You know, where did they buy it from the store? So basically what we did was for each questionnaire we went through and said, of those people who said yes, I ate this certain food, how often they provided some additional information, like qualitative information in that comment box. And that was like the percentage of the overall, and then we just kind of mapped that out. So basically the patients or their parents and guardians were more likely to get that extra information. And a lot of times we want to know if a cluster comes back, you know, how, like was it prepared in a certain way or was it homegrown or brand, was it? They were, that information was captured more frequently when the patient filled out the questionnaire themselves as opposed to when public health was getting that information.
Any other questions? One more.
Colorado. We also have a public health hotline, so I was really interested in the hotline presentation. And I'm wondering if you know what drives people to the hotline. So in our case, I think it's probably media. We refer people when they call us because we're trying to get the volume to the hotline and maybe our website. But wondering how do people know about it?
I don't know exactly. About it. I do know there's a lot of media coverage that occurs, but the thing that was interesting for us is that even though it seemed like there's a comparable amount of media coverage from hers, we didn't actually get a call. So that media coverage was not a good predictor of the volume of calls that we received. I do know that we got a lot of calls from healthcare systems and healthcare workers to verify the number, and so we know that they were verifying that because they were distributing that number to their patients. So if anybody had a question or came into the system or they produced any written material, they would put our number there because they didn't want to deal with the questions, but they wanted someone else to answer them, which is fine with us. So I think that's where a lot of it came from as well. So I think primarily media and then healthcare providers. And we also, of course, have our own website and all of the materials we produced.
Going once. All right, how about a big round of applause for everyone?